Welcome to the Bicast, a podcast for the bisexual community. Today I'd like to welcome A.M. Leibowitz here. Lynette and I had the pleasure of reading their first novel, Lower Education, and had a great discussion about schools and bisexuals with Amy. So when I saw that Passing on Faith would include trans characters as well, I made sure I got a pre-publication copy. What I love about both Lower Education and Passing on Faith is that they include LGBT people, but they are not specifically about LGBT. I feel that our coming out stories have already been well written. While many are great, and I still read and watch new ones as they come out, we need more books about us living our lives as queer. So welcome, Amy.
Hi. Hey. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you back. So let's start off with a quick tease. Tell us a little bit about Passing on Faith.
Okay, so the original concept for the story, I was working on a new novel, and I like to have a little something to kind of go on when I get started writing. So I posed the question to my family, what fairy tale do you think I should write next? Because Lower Education was a retelling of the Pied Piper. So I asked my family, and my daughter's immediate response was, you should do Puss in Boots. And I said, okay, well, that's a story I really like. And, you know, if you've seen the Shrek movies, I love Puss in Boots from the Shrek movies. So I said, I could maybe work with that. So I went back and reread Puss in Boots, and you know what? It is a terrible story. Not that Pied Piper's a great story, but Puss in Boots is an awful story. So I read that and went,
well, tell us a little bit about how you see it as awful.
It's essentially, I thought, from what I remembered, was that it was the youngest son of this family sort of gets screwed over by his deceased father, who didn't have a lot of money, but pretty much left everything he did have to the older two. And really, it kind of is about this relatively lazy young kid who falls in with a talking cat who basically gets his whole life in order for him, and this kid ends up with something for nothing. So this cat goes around just telling people lies about this youngest son, essentially saying he's this really wealthy, powerful guy. And so in the end, this guy ends up with land and money and a wife out of the whole deal because he has agreed to let the cat do everything for him and really not be very honest about it. So I'm not quite sure what the moral of the story is. And when I went back and reread it, I thought that's just, it's not a great story.
Yeah.
So, but it still formed the basis of where I went with this, the idea of a youngest son who is maybe considered the wayward son, and his family was not so keen on him. So, The beginning of the story is that he thinks that his father just didn't like him enough to leave him anything, and it turns out that his father disliked him enough to leave him a dilapidated lake house that he's then going to have to fix up and figure out how to sell in order to make it worth his while. So he is trying to figure out how he can do this without spending all of his own money and, you know, on the taxes from the inheritance and
right
the
and on a teacher yeah and on a teacher's salary, we have to add,
right on a teacher's salary. Now I mean, he is single, so a single person on a teacher's salary gets by pretty well, especially because he is from my city. I live in Rochester, and Monroe County teachers are among the highest paid in the country. So, you know, there's a little bit of he's got some cushion, but it's still not terrific that he has to deal with this. And so when he goes down to the property to try to fix it up to sell it, he has no idea what he's doing, and he ends up falling in with his next-door neighbor, who stops by to see who showed up in this house that's been empty for years. And Kat, who was actually, the name Kat was a placeholder when I started writing because I didn't have a name for him, and he took the place of Puss in Boots. But I like to hope that both of them are significantly better characters than the original youngest son and cat from the fairy tale.
Yeah. So yeah, I'll that's a good that's a good start of the first 75 pages, I think. I'll have to
just
say
about.
Yeah, I'll have to say I love Kat, and I'll say if Kat were older, I would try to date Kat. I guess you've already answered some of where the character came from, but other parts of Kat's demeanor and just like. Kat's someone who it's really great to have screen time with.
I adore him. Well, Kat is he's a mix of a bunch of different things. First, he is partly somebody that I actually knew. Just his bubbly personality, his energy, and some of his physical health issues. So he is actually partially based on somebody I know. He is partially modeled after what an actual cat is like. So there's a great scene in there that was not proposed by me. One of my friends, when she heard about the story, said, I'd love to see a scene where he's messing around on Micah's keyboard, like what an actual cat does. You know, if I'm sitting mm-hmm. there typing, my cat will think she can just come in there and join in with her own typing on my keyboard. So it was a joke that she wanted to see a scene with Kat fooling around on Micah's keyboard. So I actually wrote that into the story. So part of his personality is based on my cat, and part of it is that I sort of see him as a little bit of a personification of my writing muse. So in many ways, he's a part of me. Both Kat and Micah are aspects of my identity, and where the story came from was, how am I integrating my identity and my faith? So both of them are aspects of that in a way. So that was kind of fun to do. And yeah, I absolutely adored writing Kat. He was fun to write.
Yeah, I'll say a couple things, yeah. And, you know, you just touched on it, that Kat is a person of faith. Kat identifies as queer, and it's kind of more feminine spectrum, I would say fairly.
Yes.
Yes.
He identifies with his assigned male pronouns, and he often will say that he is male, but... although Micah sometimes refers to him as a man, Kat does not see himself that way. He doesn't associate himself with the term man any more than he associates with the term woman. So he might refer to himself maybe as a guy, but never as a man. That speaks of a particular, not necessarily just a gendered way of being, but culturally, there's something about man that means something, and he doesn't identify with that.
Yeah, yeah, I found that myself. And you know, I could see some of myself and younger self in Kat. So Kat was somebody I could identify with. I'll go to the next character. Zane. I loved Zane, too. I wanted to see more of her and her family. Tell us a little bit about Zane and her family, another part of the book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Zane was like this dark horse. I didn't know how many people who pre-read this novel, my beta readers, a couple of other people who had read advanced copies, people in my family. I didn't realize how much people would enjoy her as a character. She's another one that I like very much. She too is an amalgam of people I actually know, so some aspects of her personality, aspects of her femininity and her identity as a woman. Zane is a trans woman, and I was very surprised at how many people loved her. She has a story, and I actually am working on a Christmas short story that will end up being free on my blog to read, which is about her and how she met her wife. Her wife was sort of my rebellion against this impression that people have that that a trans woman cannot be bisexual or be a lesbian, that a trans woman must then somehow only be a very feminine trans woman, must only be attracted to men, or that a woman who is only interested in women could not possibly fall in love with a trans woman. So their relationship was born a little bit out of my slightly snarky feelings about some of the things I've heard people say.
Well, it is, yes, but I will go into that a tiny bit about the history of it. Gatekeepers used to keep people from transitioning unless they really passed as female and that they only were attracted to men. And it's something that still goes through the community. I see more lesbian identified trans women these days. So that's good. But, you know, 20 years ago, it would have been very, very difficult to get any kind of hormone treatment or surgery identifying as a trans woman that loves women. Yeah. And so, you know, it comes with a history.
Yeah. So I enjoyed writing them very much. She is married to a woman who has children who are close to adulthood. They're older teenagers. So I imagine that there's probably a bit of an age difference there. But I like them very much as a couple, and they have a story which I won't spoil here because I am working on my little Christmas short. But that is their history and how they met.
So great.
I will just
read that because I did love seeing and yeah, and a tiny bit that you know, Mika and Zane have a long, long history together and really BFFs.
Yes. Yes. He was really, I mean, as much in love as teenagers ever are with her, and he didn't know at that time that she was a woman. So he saw her when they were young as a boy, and she had a big part in his formation of his identity as realizing that he was only at that point attracted to boys. So part of his coming out story involved her, that she had come out as trans, and unlike him, her family was supportive. I perceived, you know, I always know a lot about my characters, including most of the side characters or the ones who aren't really the point of view characters. And I perceived her as someone whose family would have been supportive of her, mm-hmm. just because it fit her character and it fit the situation. And so unlike Micah, she had a supportive family, and he drew on that strength in order to manage his life.
Yeah, I say going through the book and some of the flashback kind of stuff, I did find that she was there for him a lot.
Yes.
So next question. So this book is about faith. It's about losing and finding it. It can be hard being both of faith and LGBT in this world. So much of the time, those who hate us drown out the voices who are welcoming us. So many of us, like Mika, is both rejected by family and church. So let's talk God a bit. Why was it so important for you to write about faith?
At the time I was writing this, I was really struggling with being a person of faith. I'd grown up in the Unitarian Church, actually, and as a teenager, kind of got sucked into a very conservative version of Christianity. So I spent a lot of years suppressing my own identity and perpetuating other people, suppressing theirs. And I spent a long time there, and I think the beginning of the end was I went to graduate school, and I didn't go to a Christian college for that. So I met a whole lot of people who opened my eyes to the world being much larger than I had perceived it as a person who was relatively sheltered in my faith community. Mm-hmm. And that was a point when I began to reject a lot of the things that I had learned through the conservative version of my religion. But at the same time, we were actually leaving one church for another one that was even more conservative than the one we had been at. So I think if we'd stayed at the one we were at, I would have had a little more flexibility in questioning and in thinking about some of these ways in which I wanted to reject some of the most conservative teaching. But we ended up at a church that was even more conservative. And in order to fit in, I continued to suppress my own identity and to try to avoid being overt in any support that I wanted to give for LGBT people, not identifying at that point myself as one. So it took many years after that before I finally had just really had enough. It was enough. A lot of things converged at the same time to make that true, and I realized that in raising our kids, I didn't want them in that environment. So we left that church, but I left that church very angry and disillusioned and not sure that I wanted to be a person of faith. So this story was actually born out of some of my expression of being angry at having to repress myself for all those years, and yet at the same time really wanting to hang on to that kernel of faith because it had been such an integral part of my life. And at some point in there, I was coming in contact with people who were starting to talk about things like queer theology and queer interpretations of the Bible, and I was so fascinated that this existed and it wasn't this monstrosity that the church or this perversion that the church had said it was. It was actually quite beautiful. So in learning about that, that was part of where some of Kat's elements of faith came from, that he wholly integrates his faith and his identity. They are not two separate things. They are one thing. They are him. Mm-hmm. And he sees things like he sees queer sex as holy. And he sees his personhood as worthy. And so this is really eye-opening for Micah, who has never seen himself as whole or worthy or loved by God. He sees God as a cosmic jerk, which is not surprising given the fact that that was basically what he learned growing up. So
I will bring in that. And it is like he is part of a family who went even more conservative in his father's generation.
Yes.
And that says a lot about, I see it as how some mainstream Christians became more conservative over the years. Churches that when LGBT issues started hitting the church, that some became much more conservative.
Oh, yes.
Uh-oh.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, LGBT issues became the thing for churches to kind of hang their hat on. And, you know, this is the thing we're going to fight against and make it the dividing point, in essence. And I don't think it needs to be that way.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, I see a lot of welcoming churches, at least around here. Even making that a battle is really about turning people away from faith. And I think that, at least for LGBT people, it's made it so that they've actually become anti-religious because of all of this hate coming that they see coming out of faith, and not just LGBT people. I think millennials too. You know, you look at the statistics showing that millennials are not choosing to be people of faith, and I think a lot of it has to do with these years and years of a few very hateful ministers putting this negative energy out. So it just turns people completely away from all the good things that church and church community has to offer.
Yes. My church is a welcoming and affirming church, and there are many others. My city has numerous ones. When we were looking for a new church, we were specifically looking for one that was welcoming and affirming, and the list was overwhelming. We actually ended up choosing our church because we drove past it, and the kids said, "There's a playground. Can we try that one?" So knowing it was at the top of my list to try, we did, and the plan was to try a few others, but we liked it so much we stayed. So we've now been there for several years, and it is really a very welcoming place to be. So there are many churches that are like that, but at the same time, as glad as I am to have a place that was welcoming, it was hard being there at first because I did have so much of that pent-up disconnect and frustration and anger. But over time, I found it a place where I was able to heal, and I think that's true for many people. But I think it can be equally healing to be away, to say, you know what, that's not something I need in my life, and I'm away from that. And there are healthy ways to do that, too. So I'm actually pretty sympathetic to the people who have rejected their faith tradition of origin, and I understand where those feelings come from, and I don't fault people for feeling that way.
Yeah, it becomes a problem to me when my own faith is challenged by people that have rejected faith. And, you know, I think that, you know, the reality is that, you know, there are a million different paths to your own spirituality, and each one of them should be respected as long as they're not hurting anybody else.
Yes. Yeah, it can actually be very difficult when people say things about how we must be self-hating if we're people of faith. Well, no, I was actually much more self-hating before I was able to reconcile those things. But so as much as I do understand, sometimes there can be some things people say that are relatively hurtful. but I, like I said, I understand where that comes from.
Yeah, I went through it myself. I was an atheist for some years, and you know, my joke now is that I was just between religions. I consider myself pagan, but very much ecumenical. So, you know, I try to fit in all the good aspects of every religion and at least accept them. So.
Yeah. And it's really been neat because as I've found other people, especially other LGBT people of faith, that there's such a wide range of different faiths and different expressions, and it has just been marvelous. Being away from a confining version of Christian faith means that I can be, again, yeah, very, very much open to, hey, this is working for you, and isn't this cool where we can both be people of faith and that is contributing to a positive effect on our lives. And so I really have enjoyed the fact that there's all of this wide open territory now that I wasn't aware of before.
Yeah. You could have stuck with the Unitarians. How did that come about? Were your parents Unitarian?
Well, my mom actually was something very conservative evangelical, and my dad is Jewish, and when they got together, I don't really know the whole story, but she didn't end up converting, and when they got married and then moved to where we live now, where I grew up, they ended up at a Unitarian church. So we all went there because it was a place that was
neutral.
Yeah. And then I ended up with a friend who invited me to her youth group and then to her church. So I don't think my parents weren't overly impressed with that. But I like to hope that now that I'm away from that, that my mom has been gone for many years, but I like to hope that she would be pleased with the way that my life has turned out now.
Yeah. Next question. The novel is set in the Finger Lakes. My partner Jane and I included Seneca Lake on our honeymoon, so it's a place close to us. And that's because she went to William Smith, and we went back and saw people that were still, you know, like professional students and professional TAs. So, you know, Four Chimneys Organic Winery was always part of our trips up there. And a great winery. They used to make champagne and, like, probably the best champagne that was made in the United States, I'll say. So I want you to talk about the local life in the story. Connections that Kat has and lives by, and all the kind of people that keep a resort or, you know, a vacation community together, from the electrician to the carpenters to the people that do house cleaning every Saturday or Sunday morning when the new guests arrive.
Right. Well, the first thing is that the lake house is based on not actually a property on Seneca Lake. I had friends growing up who had property on Keuka Lake and other Finger Lakes. So I was familiar with some of the places that we've been. We used to take trips every summer to visit some of our friends who had lake houses. So I liked the idea of having a house on the lake. I wanted to set it in some place that was far enough that it wasn't going to be, well, Micah could just go there and fix it up on the weekends. It's an hour away. Why can't he just do that? Some place he would prefer to be to stay for the whole summer, because the commute might be a little long for him to want to do that every day to make sure things were going well with repairs. I also wanted to set it farther south because I just think the area is gorgeous down near Watkins Glen, Painted Post, that whole area, which is just beautiful. So I wanted to set it down near there. And I also kind of wanted to create this tiny little town that was maybe a little bit idyllic. I mean, there's a good deal of idealism in me in the idea that there could be a town that perhaps brought itself forward into the 21st century. Maybe the town was a little more conservative in the past, but as families have changed and as it's become more of a tourist area, that perhaps this is an area that is very LGBT friendly. So the community of people are people Kat, who grew up in that area, knew because these are friends and family that he's known his whole life. So they sort of have a little bit of a fondness for him as someone they've known since he was born. And he knows everyone and everyone knows him, because how can you possibly not know your local queer person who's very feminine spectrum, but most people would sort of perceive as a gay man? How could you not know someone like that if you have a small town? Everyone knows everyone else. Mm-hmm. So he would obviously know everyone, and his connections through his work would have put him in touch with everyone. So my idealism is showing a little bit there, in that these are people who know him and love him, as opposed to people who know him and want to harm him. So Micah has actually gone from a place where Rochester is an odd city, in the sense that we have lots of LGBT families here and lots of LGBT culture, but we're also strangely conservative and kind of racist. So we can be an odd mix of things. And so he might have gone from being relatively sheltered in this church and thinking there's no place outside of this where people are just welcomed, to a town where, wow, this isn't strange. People don't think anything of it if we walk down the street together. So I wanted to juxtapose that a little bit, in that that's partially my experience of, again, having grown up here myself.
Yeah. I would imagine, I mean, Ithaca's not that far away.
No.
No. And Ithaca is one of those towns where, you know, everything is okay.
Yeah.
And sometimes a little too much when it comes to some of the drug use in that town, I will say. Yeah. But, you know, that's a college town.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is such a great story, and I felt like so much connected in it. And the more I read your novels, the more I learn about the pieces, the elements that you put in. I will say that you're one of these writers who writes from what they know. Mm-hmm. And it really helps me as a writer understand, like, really, like, being familiar with material, being familiar with your life and making changes and tweaking it and sharing it.
Yes.
It's a great, it's great way to write, and it makes easy read, because you don't go through and say, well, that's not where that should have happened.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. I mean,
that was the wrong movie maker. You should have done research.
Right. We all take a few liberties, but yeah, I do put in a lot of research into if I'm unfamiliar with something or if there's been something. Like, I was familiar with Kat's medical condition, but I wasn't familiar with newer treatments. So I literally watched YouTube videos on people doing home care. So even if I know something or know something about it, it still involves quite a bit of research. But yeah, I always start from a place of, yes, I know something about this. Let's go with that.
So is there anything else you want to share about the book?
You know, I think we've pretty well covered it all.
Yeah.
It was a fun book to write. Well,
yeah,
sort of.
It was a fun and great book to read. There's some heavy parts in it,
yeah.
But you know, that's life. Life isn't always nice. But I actually, you know, I will just, without spoiling, I will say that there's a great chase at the end of the book.
Yeah.
And you almost don't see it coming. And it's great to have a chase scene in the book, so to speak. So thanks for coming by, Amy. Links to purchase Passing on Faith and Amy's other work will be provided on the site. And thank you.
Yep. Anytime.
Sure. Remember, you are not wrong. You're not broken. You're not alone. You're a human being and you're a bisexual. Bye.